Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your mediated playlist of music news and analysis. I'm your host, Ben Ratliff. I'm here with John Pareles. Hi, John.
Hey, Ben.
And John Caramonica.
Yo.
You just heard Dimed Out by the band Titus Andronicus. I guess that leads us into our first topic of the day, which is something I wrote about, the idea of a lot of music I heard being sort of stuffed, if not long, actually, temporally, then stuffed with ideas, with themes. It's like sort of like concept albums gone crazy. Muchness is what I called it. Muchness in all forms.
A very swagnificent piece.
Thank you very much.
If I might say so myself.
Thanks.
Yeah.
And the Titus Andronicus record this year was a prime example of that. A double album, so, you know, it was long.
But especially for a punk album, it was long.
Yeah, yeah. But it's more than that. It was like there was so much in every song. It was like sort of climbing a mountain every 5 minutes. And that was something that I felt in many things I was listening to. Admittedly, we're not talking about top 40, but I heard it in Kendrick Lamar's record for sure. I heard it in Kamasi Washington's record. I heard it in Joanna Newsom's record. And did you guys feel any of that?
I did. And I wonder, I've been thinking a lot about fragmentation. What most people are interpreting fragmentation as is a constant fight for people's attention. So I feel like most people's response to fragmentation is, I want to do something short and loud or noisy or quick and a burst that kind of draws the eyes or draws the ears.
Something that's easy to grasp.
Right. Something that cuts through. But this is maybe another potentially logical response fragmentation, which is I accept my role in this niche and I'm just going to inhabit it and like fill it like a gas.
Anybody who will commit will get a lot.
Right. If you're already finding me in my niche, you're not going to leave. So I have you. And once I have you, I can make you listen to 3 CDs.
Yeah. It's the other side of the coin. And I would never say that it's happening to the exclusion of concision. But there's a lot of muchness at the same time as there being a lot of concision.
Well, there's also, we're in a hyperlinked universe now. So your Titus Andronicus or Joanna Newsom lyric will make a reference that people are going to go Google. I mean, mm-hmm. We're in the genius.com annotation era. Mm-hmm. And so they expect people to make that commitment. So it's like, I'm going to give you as much as you can handle and you'll find something out mm-hmm. and we're going to pile more on.
Even in our business, it's the story behind the story that everybody, they want both. They want the story mm-hmm. and the story behind the story.
They want the podcast.
They want our hard drives. They want our notes.
Please,
I mean, Kool AD, right?
The
Kool AD 100 song album.
You can literally just have my damn hard drive at this point. I'll start over in 2016.
It is like, here's my hard drive. Mm-hmm.
Do you think it bespeaks deepening commitment on the part of fans in this era?
That's the interesting question, because I think we'll take what artists give us. If it's done with enough purpose, we'll take it. We'll figure out a way to retrain our hearing and our expectations mm-hmm. to that. But I think artists are driving it. I do think artists are driving
right.
it. The question is why?
Well, I think in this particular age, an artist feels confident that people are going to find – the right people are going to find them. So rather than making a sort of preemptive decision to alter or shift or create a different version of one's art in search of an audience, you make the art that you want to make, trusting that the mechanisms are in place to be found.
Right.
And some people, like some of the people you're talking about, are naturally inclined in this direction. Like Kendrick is like a perfect example of a guy who would not thrive in 2005, you know, or 2003 or 4, like peak radio single rap, mm-hmm. like ringtone rap era. Like he wouldn't thrive. He's thriving in this because it turns out that there are distribution mechanisms that are well suited to what he does
yeah.
and to finding those fans. It's the same reason that someone like, J. Cole is successful or whatever.
Yeah.
Also, people just got tired of Shallow.
No.
No?
I'm not.
Well, you excluded.
I mean,
I'm a critic.
I halfway believe that. But then, you know, there's always people who want a 3-minute pop song.
Yeah, I mean,
it's not either or.
No, and I think these things coexist and are increasingly coexisting in the pop space, which is pretty striking. You mentioned at the end of your Muchness piece, you talked about the prog era, and you're talking about Yes and sort of bands with, you know, 17-minute songs and whatnot. And there was a time when, like, that was at the, you know, not center is maybe a strong word, but it was certainly much closer to the center of the pop universe. Mm-hmm. And I think we may be moving back towards that time because the mechanisms of what make a pop hit, whether it's a single or an album, are not what they used to be.
Yeah.
It's not purely radio play. It's streams. It's album sales. But, it's all these other metrics that – if you're the type of person that's just going to put the Kendrick Lamar album on repeat on Spotify or the Kamasi album on repeat on Spotify, like all of a sudden there are metrics now to capture that kind of listening. What we think of as a hit, as you alluded to, may evolve as the metrics evolve.
It's funny because there used to be a sort of facile drugs theory of popular music, you know, depending on what people were taking.
Yeah, sure.
That was what shaped the music.
Uh-huh.
But now it's not about that. I mean, obviously, the point is, forget about the drugs. It's just like whatever is making us hear.
It's the medium.
In a certain way.
Yeah, I mean, it's the intermediary. Here's the thing. It's just as easy to stream a 6-minute song as it is to stream a 3-minute song.
Well, it takes you 6 minutes.
It does, but that means you don't have to get up. you know what I mean? Like if you're building your day around streamed playlists, or like it doesn't matter if your playlist is a bunch of 3-minute songs or a bunch of 5-minute songs or a bunch of 9-minute songs.
Mm-hmm. Well, the other
if
thing
that's
is,
how you're curating your day, you already have the whole thing built.
Also, the other thing is you can try more stuff with streams. Mm. With the hit that's been sold you by radio, you go out and get what you want. With streaming, you're encouraged to delve deeper,
right?
Or to try that song that wasn't on the radio but has the weird title, or you know, happens to go on for 17 minutes,
right?
And I do want to mention, though, I don't think we're going to talk about Adele in depth at this moment. That song "Hello" was almost 5 minutes long, and there were a few number one songs other than Adele that were maybe a hair over 4 minutes. She pushed it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think those final
20%.
30 or 40 seconds really count.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you feel something in a number one song of that length.
Sure. Oh, I don't know if Z100 plays those final 40 seconds, though.
Is there – I don't know if there's a radio version of
Adele.
There's
a radio version of everything.
Is that true?
I mean, even if there's not, there's a guy who can push the button and say, and now –
oh,
Bruno
there is
Mars.
That guy. Yes. Yeah, I'm familiar with that guy.
Calvin Harris. Rita Ora.
Kendrick Lamar was one of the princes of muchness, but he was also part of a force in music this year that had a lot to do with the Black Lives Matter movement and social rights in general.
Mm-hmm.
Why don't we listen to just a clip from All Right?
Sure.
We gonna be all right. We gonna be all right. Do you hear me? Do you feel me? We gonna be all right.
And when I wake up, I recognize you looking at me for the pay cut. Bahamas, I be looking at you from the face down. One Mac 11 even boom with the bass down. Skimming, and let me tell you about my life. Painkillers only put me in a twilight. We're pretty Benjamin is the highlight. Now tell my mama I love her, but this what I like. Lord knows, 20 of them in my Chevy. Tell them all to come and get me, reaping everything I sow. So my karma come in heaven, no preliminary hearings on my record. I'm a gangsta in silence for the record.
So All Right is an example of a number of songs and moments in pop this year where you heard anger and frustration.
Mm-hmm.
That energy helped shape things, not just within the Black Lives Matter movement, but in other areas, in other political areas.
I think it's the second year running now that you've had a legitimate protest streak in popular music.
Yeah.
And probably this year, we're talking last year and this year, probably the more effective of the 2 years, but also maybe the inflection point where it got diffuse and the message was getting lost a little bit because of that, in my opinion. You know, you had people like Pharrell and Usher putting out protest songs that basically just, you know, they bricked.
Right.
And that's not to say, like, the nature of protest is a brick, because it's obviously not. But there was maybe a questioning of why these people, why now, you know, it coming from Kendrick, who has sort of like an organic intellectual energy and has had that for 4 or 5 years. where someone like Pharrell, that's not what has historically been in his music, and Usher, certainly, it's not what historically has been in this music. Mm-hmm. You know, there were these sort of admirable efforts to bring issues to the forefront, but I think in terms of the reception, public reception, there was a filter process of like, oh, we'll take it here, but we don't accept it here.
But also, both the Kendrick album and the D'Angelo album, which was also full of street consciousness, they weren't sloganeering. They made things more complex. Kendrick questions himself throughout that entire album, and D'Angelo is, you know, piling on muchness of layers of jazz and funk and every sort of sonic thing he can put on. So, I mean, people, interestingly, took more kindly to the more complex, ambiguous statements and less to the, you know, jingle slogan of Pharrell.
This was also the year that more people, more newcomers, heard of Nina Simone for the first time, probably since, you know, 1965 or something. Mm-hmm. That was sort of interesting, too. You know, there just seemed to be a general readiness for musicians from the present or the past who are willing to speak out.
I mean, you know, not to get too reductive about it, but if you look at the kind of the financial success and cultural impact of mainstream hip hop from, say, 1990, mid-90s to mid to late 2000s, what that did was sort of like incredible in terms of the visibility of black creativity in America. But the way that the industry worked, it sort of narrowed the themes in black popular music. And you ended up with the idea of political rap or socially conscious music being a fringe thing. Mm-hmm. Whereas if you looked at, say, hip hop in the early to mid 90s, you can make a case that it was actually at the center or near the center.
Right.
And obviously there's inherent politics in black capitalist success. Like that's a political thing as well, but it's not often understood as one. You know, it's not, we don't think of it in the same way as we think of like a Public Enemy as being explicitly political. So this year, I think, was probably the first year, or really last year and this year, was when the first time we really see a loosening of what people understand of as centrist hip-hop themes. And this is something I talked about earlier in the year. I was talking about sort of the silent majority of hip-hop, which is Kendrick and J. Cole. It's not Drake and Kanye. It's Kendrick and J. Cole. They sell a tremendous amount of records. They have a incredibly heavy presence. They sell out they sell out arenas. You know, they're super successful touring and financially very successful, but their radio play doesn't really line up with their actual success and impact.
Right.
And so you begin to see like, oh, well, radio is a metric. For a while, that's what we were kind of using and saying, well, that's what popular hip hop is. But I don't think we can say that anymore. And I think that's incredibly important because it reflects an entire audience that's being underserved by our traditional systems, but is there and wants that information, wants that creativity.
And also they're not tied to the hook. Kendrick Lamar's album was not a big hook album. Even J. Cole.
Hookless wonder.
But people are hungry for, as you say, the information and the creativity in ways other than what a radio consultant is going to say will sound good on the air between commercials.
Right.
So that leads us into another topic involving an artist who is at the center of hip-hop hit radio and made basically a political statement this year on Twitter. We're talking about Nicki Minaj.
True, yeah.
Communicating with Taylor Swift.
Communicating at Taylor Swift, perhaps, is maybe a better way of putting.
Or maybe miscommunicating.
Well, you know, one of them was miscommunicating. You know, Nicki, and I think this is a good example. And this is why I sometimes blanch when people say that, like, mainstream rap or, like, party rap or whatever, like, that there's no politics in it. Because, like, there's two parts of this. One, it's implicitly political. In a sort of universe, in a country that sort of can deny black creativity, like in a systematic way, the idea that like there is all this black success is implicitly a political thing.
Right.
There's value in that. But also the people who are making these records, they're not dumb. Like they understand the system in which they're working with. And Nicki's a good example of someone who is not making political rap in any kind of explicit way. But when it came time to dressing down Taylor Swift, like did it with the quickness and like just a very, very savvy understanding of the systems that are in place that implicitly privilege white creativity over black creativity. Something that Taylor, with her perspective and where she's coming from, just couldn't have understood, mm-hmm. wouldn't have understood.
And publicly didn't.
Very publicly didn't. Yeah, I mean, it was Taylor has been above reproach in a lot of ways for the past few years. You know, she took on Apple and she won and, you know, cool kids like her, dorks like her. Everybody likes Taylor Swift. This is the first time someone very effectively took Taylor down, and it took like 8 minutes.
No, it was social media ninjery.
It was great.
What else happened in that sphere this year?
There's the Drake battle.
Drake and Meek Mill, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
And
can I throw in my personal favorite, which is Anita Baker and Cheryl Lynn getting mad at each other?
What was going on there?
I'm not really sure, to be honest. I think one of them blocked the other one, and then I think it was maybe Cheryl Lynn blocked Anita Baker, and then Anita Baker said some sideways stuff or vice versa. I don't know. I just love the idea that Anita Baker and Cheryl Lynn are warring on Twitter in 2015.
Though some of this, I do think, you know, get off your Twitter account and write another damn song.
Tweet is more valuable than a song in 2015.
Is it?
Sometimes with some of the people I follow, yes.
Well, to some extent, this is something that's come up actually in a number of other conversations we've had on this program.
this ongoing cultural product.
They can be equivalent, actually, a tweet and a song.
Yeah. Look, Drake wrote a diss song about Meek Mill that got nominated for a Grammy. Like, when we look back 20 years from now, we will all think of the Drake song. We'll all think of Drake back to back and be like, wow, he really got the better of that. But none of that would have happened if Meek didn't write those two or three tweets. So you can make the case that Drake doesn't get a Grammy nomination if Meek doesn't go on Twitter.
A spur to creativity.
Yeah. For artists for whom their public persona is as big as their music or as tactile as their music, yeah, tweet counts.
Well, it's just part of the whole thing about getting out in front of the conversation is an extremely creative and powerful act.
Yeah.
And now we're in this moment of to what extent can you control your reception. It is possible to do it. You know, it is possible for you to do it unmediated by your record label or your manager or anybody else.
And this and Nicki, to bring it back to Nicki, is a very good example of here's a person who clearly is far more complicated than her music. And I've always felt that. And this is a year where she used non-musical media to express that. And there is enough non-musical media to accommodate that, whether it is her Twitter account or whether it is her basically walking out on a New York Times Magazine interview because she didn't like the questions or whatever it was. This is Nicki being full Nicki. In my mind, to properly consume an artist like her or like Drake or Beyonce or whoever, you have to take them at their whole. Like writing about music in 2015 is not merely writing about albums.
It's writing about celebrity.
Right. And it's writing about how these people in particular use multiple platforms to tell one unified narrative.
They're leveraging popular culture with songs, clothes.
They're seeding and then letting the distribution mechanisms do a lot of the work.
So related to all this, let's hear a little bit of Drake's Back to Back.
Yeah, I learned a game from William Wesley. You can never check me. Back to back for the that didn't get the message. Back to back like I'm on the cover of Lethal Weapon. Back to back like I'm Jordan 96, 97. Ooh, very important and very pretentious. When I look back, I might be mad that I gave this attention. Yeah, but it's weighing heavy on my conscience. Yeah, and you left the boy no options. I wanna see my go insane. You gon' make me step out of my frame. You gon' make me buy bottles for Charlemagne. You gon' make me go out.
Another theme in music this year, almost across the board, was that it was a year of tremendous excellence for women artists of all kinds, really.
Mm-hmm.
Shall we enumerate?
I think, I mean, you wanna
start with country music?
Let's start with country. This is a bumpy year in country. I think generally speaking, most of the best country music being made right now is being made by women, like just basic facts. But this was a year where the tension in Nashville really came to the fore with that whole, the guy who said the unenlightened thing about tomatoes and salad.
Yeah.
That was a bad thing. That guy shouldn't have said that. But like I said, the irony of that was, I think if you just look around, you have Kelsea Ballerini, you have Kacey Musgraves, you have Maddie and Tay. Reba McEntire made a great record this year. Janet Kramer had one of my top 15 singles this year. Like, there's so much interesting music being made by female singers and female-fronted groups in Nashville. it's so weird when you look at a country radio station, a typical country radio playlist, and it's just dude after dude after dude,
right?
Who are all making variations on the same song. And like, I'm sure that like some advertising council somewhere has decided that those are the best songs to sell to the people who listen to that radio station, but it does terrible things for the genre.
So we're talking about a system in which radio is leading. In other words, an opening has been made in radio, and following that, more women songwriters are allowed to flourish. More women singers are being signed up.
I think it's still more fringy in country because radio is still pretty unforgiving.
No, you're saying radio is the wall of the bros.
Yeah, no, I'm saying radio is sort of the problem still. Women have a harder time cracking. Even someone like Carrie Underwood, who is not maybe my favorite female country singer.
So then what accounts for this, for the great upsurge?
Well, I think maybe it's in the same thing that in the same way that muchness happens when people are left to their own devices, I think maybe in a weird way, if you're a female singer on a major label and no one's expecting you to be Taylor Swift, maybe they just let you go make a great record.
Mm-hmm.
That could be it.
Mm-hmm.
No one's – there's less meddling.
Well, no, there's –
whereas if you're like a dude, you're like, where's your Trucks and Flip-Flops record? Mm-hmm. And then you got to go make a Trucks and Flip-Flops record.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if the women aren't going to fit into the radio box anyway
– there's maybe less pressure. And just for the record, if any dude country singers are listening, please do not make a Trucks and Flip-Flops song. Just stop. If you're making one right now, just stop.
Nashville really? Just suddenly went silent.
Yeah.
20 studios are all on lunch break now.
We also heard really great records from Kalayla and U.S. Girls, mm-hmm. and Julia Holter and Downtown Boys.
Julian Baker.
And Torres and
yeah,
and lots of bands where a woman was basically the singer, the songwriter, the main thing.
A thing I thought about a lot this year was when I was covering the Pitchfork Festival, I want to say 2 years ago. It wasn't this summer, and I'm pretty sure it wasn't. I think it was 2013.
Yeah. I remember this conversation we had.
And I was watching, you know, like male-fronted indie rock bands.
Yeah.
Two or three of them basically sort of like eye-rolling their way through their sets about like, oh, how absurd it is to be like the condition of the male indie rock singer.
As I recall, you were saying that it was almost like they were confessing their own exhaustion with themselves.
That's
having to maintain this charade. And like there's nothing at stake anymore.
I want to be completely open about the fact that I could just purely be projecting my own fatigue with that onto these guys.
No, but
it felt real.
In lots of records I heard this year and performances I saw this year, I did have the feeling of, I'm so glad I'm watching this woman on stage and not another guy.
That makes a lot of sense. And I feel like it's been happening for a few years. You know, I felt that very strongly when I saw Swearin' for the first time, mm-hmm. and when I saw Waxahachie, Speedy Ortiz. I've been feeling this moment, and it's been exciting. And this year, I just feel like basically almost every rock record I liked was by either a female singer or a female-fronted band.
Yeah.
Even the Pretty Reckless, which is a mainstream rock band fronted by Taylor Momsen, who used to be on Gossip Girl, that is a great rock album. I think it maybe came out late last year, but it's still like, it's a very popular, it's like an ongoing popular radio rock band.
Mm-hmm. And out in the mainstream, Florence and the Machine.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
You know, heroic female archetypes. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're everywhere.
And in this, you know, super niche world of punk and hardcore, it felt like an endless row of really good records. Failed Mutation and Sheer Mag and Gouge Away and Vex and Downtown Boys and Patsy. Ever heard Patsy?
I haven't. Got to get involved with that?
Yeah, you do.
Okay, I'm going to get involved with it.
So,
but just like what a genuine relief. And it's interesting because, you know, there's been a lot of people making parallels between this moment and your sort of like early Riot Girl moment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's some ways in which that makes sense and others in which it doesn't. But what's striking is that you're starting to see some real intergenerational conversations. Like you're seeing people talk about Kathleen Hanna and Kathleen Hanna talking back to some of these people in a positive way.
And Slater-Kinney came back.
Slater-Kinney literally played Market Hotel last night. Slater-Kinney, that's a famous band. Mm-hmm. They played Market Hotel. That's not a famous venue.
Right.
The idea that is happening, to me, it's mind-blowing, and it speaks really well both of like the current generation seeing historical precedents, and also the older generation who is alert enough and alive to what's happening right now to be able to have that dialogue. And that made me really happy.
Well, I went to one of those Sleater-Kinney gigs at Music Hall of Williamsburg, and what struck me was there was just as much singing along to the new album 10 years later as there was to the old songs. So they're hitting a second wave of fans.
So let's hear a little bit of a song by the aforementioned Downtown Boys, the song Future Police. Related to the issue of women in popular music, I think we have to talk about Adele.
Oh, yeah, I've heard of her.
Hmm.
Is it related, though?
Why do you ask that question?
Isn't Adele sort of a one of one?
Well, she's one of the very, very, very few people who can sell. Well, she's the only person who can sell that many records.
That is true.
But she's one of the very, very few people who can sell records anywhere near that scale. But I guess the difference with Adele is that she sells to people over 30. She sells to people under 30. She has a greater reach.
She has a multi-generational audience.
Yeah. So how does she do it? What's the story being told through that music?
Well, I want to connect her for a second to your indie rock women explosion, which is to say, we're sick of guys whining about how much they suffer. When women go into their own pain and trauma and fury, it's cathartic. It's a different perception based on gender. So the vulnerability of a Julian Baker or of a Waxahachie or a lot of those wonderful, or Torres, of those wonderful female songwriters, Adele's out there being vulnerable too in a big, massively produced, beautifully sung, very straightforwardly pop way. But I think there is a connection in that we as listeners will accept vulnerability from women in ways that seem self-parodying from men.
A lot of people who wrote knowledgeably about this record were trying to say in various ways that they felt that the record was slightly corny.
Mawkish,
right? But I think there was also a sense of like a willingness to look past that because why?
Well, beautiful voice, nice
beautiful
melodies.
Beautiful voice. One of the best recorded voices I've heard in recent times too. You heard that voice 360 degrees.
But also, everyday emotions, you know, they are cliches sometimes.
Yeah.
Somebody has to express those. That's what popular music has been good at.
What's an analogy of a guy putting out that kind of mawkishness?
Sam Smith.
And it works on some level?
It does. I mean, it's funny. It's worth, we should just briefly acknowledge we're talking about putting vulnerability online. We are also sort of in the middle of like a full-throated emo revival. So there are like no shortage of like dudes being whiny in guitar bands right now. It's just worth throwing that out there as an idea. But to come back to this, you know, Justin Bieber. Mm-hmm. Justin Bieber does it. Mm-hmm. Not in the same way, but sort of does a similar thing.
He says he's sorry. Adele says she's very sorry.
Very sorry. Justin Bieber is very sorry. He texted me and asked me to tell you. But, you know, what's striking about Adele, if we don't think about Adele in that context of that sort of confessional singer-songwriter, but you think her in the context of basically single-name superstars, Beyonce, Taylor,
Cher,
Rihanna, there's a lot of bossness in the music of those people that there is not in Adele's music. And the fact that Adele can like somehow match the scale of those artists.
She can double the scale of those artists.
But still maintain that accessible intimacy, that's a kind of a killer combination because it's not something that Beyonce does. And Taylor does it in a different sort of more naive way.
You mean to say that she's not overbearing?
She's not bionic.
There's texture. Like there's sometimes Beyonce can lack texture, even though, I mean, live, that's not the case, but certainly on record sometimes that could be the case. Mm-hmm. And sometimes when you want to feel powerful, that's a great thing to have. But there is something differently textured about Adele.
So who would have thought that it's texture? It's that kind of nuanced quality that sells billions of records.
Isn't that the only thing? It's the only thing we listen for.
Well, that's what we listen for. But those people out there,
everyone,
that's what they want too.
Everyone's a critic.
I've heard that before. So to close out this discussion of Adele and of 2015, let's hear All I Ask from Adele's record.
Get a Kleenex.
The world-beating record. Thank you, John Pareles and John Caramonica. See you next year.
See you next year.
All I ask is if this is my last night with you, hold me like I'm more than just a friend. Give me a memory I can use. Take me back.
That's our show. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you have a happy new year. And our producers are Tamara Best and Jocelyn Gonzalez. You can hear a lot of the music we are talking about today on our Spotify playlist. Look at our top 10 lists and such at nytimes.com/music. And we'll see you shortly.